It's Philosophy Talk.
The ancients believed in a world suffused with meaning and purpose.
Can we?
I just happen to have a Dylan song here, which says this better than I can say it.
Darkness at the break of noon.
Darkness at noon. I've got nothing, Ma, to live up to. It's easy to see without looking too far that nothing is really sacred.
Not much is really sacred.
Is it possible to re-enchant the world?
What an opportunity.
Where could meaning come from?
From God? From nature? From the self?
Our guest is Hubert Dreyfus from UC Berkeley.
We can now give things any meaning that we please. We don't need any external authority.
It's all right, Ma. It's life and life only.
Nihilism and meaning.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're recording the program in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originated at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is nihilism and meaning.
Nihilism, or nihilism, take your choice. Nothing matters, so that doesn't. Nihilism, of course, is based on a Latin word for nothing, nihil. Nihilism is used for a lot of positions in philosophy, Ken. The position that there's nothing at all, the position that we know nothing at all, that there are no moral principles at all, and virtually any other philosophical position that could be framed using the word nothing. But the most common use, and what we'll explore today, is nihilism as a view that nothing we do, nothing we create, nothing we love, has any meaning or value whatsoever.
Wow. You know, John, nihilism not only captures a philosophical point of view, but a certain mood, a certain anxiety and melancholy. Is this all there is? Is all of humanity just a paltry few years of events on an insignificant planet about which the universe cares nothing at all? Does anything matter? For most people, it isn't a problem posed by reading philosophy, but by absorbing the modern point of view, modern life, the minuscule place in the world that humans have, that science and philosophy have taught us that humans have.
Nihilism first came into the philosophical vocabulary a couple hundred years ago as an accusation. It didn't start off with a philosopher saying, "I am a nihilist," but with a philosopher saying to another philosopher, "You are a nihilist." Some philosophers felt that if what certain other philosophers said was true, then everything would be meaningless.
And that was supposed to function as a sort of reductio ad absurdum, right? Because of course there's meaning, but your view undercuts meaning. You know, a fellow named Friedrich Jacobi said that Kantian philosophy, my favorite philosopher, particularly as developed by Johann Fichte, led to nihilism, the view that nothing mattered. That's because Fichte's philosophy didn't rest on faith and revelation, but on a limited conception of reason. He emphasized the self as the beginning of philosophy.
Jacobi, the accuser, I think, put his finger on the fundamental dialectic of nihilism. Most religions, many philosophies, and the common beliefs of many people suppose that the source of value is something beyond us, something beyond humans, something beyond the physical world, something beyond the natural world. If not God, then some transcendent realm, maybe a realm of transcendent forms like Plato thought. Nihilism as an accusation is a challenge. If you don't believe in God or something else transcendent and eternal, why does anything matter?
You know, and then by the time we get to Nietzsche, another one of my favorite philosophers, we have a philosopher actually embracing nihilism in the way he says, God is dead, everything is permitted, and hooray for that.
But there's a little bit of ambiguity there, Ken. Think of Jacobi's basic point as an argument. First premise, all meaning and value must have a transcendent source. Second premise, if you don't have God, faith, and revelation, then there is no transcendent source. Conclusion, on your godless view, whether you admit it or not, there is no meaning. Now, I don't really think Nietzsche accepted the conclusion that there was not any meaning.
Well, I see your point, and it's a good point. He accepted, though, that there wasn't the kind of meaning that Jacobi wanted, but not that there was no meaning.
No, I think Nietzsche would qualify the first premise. Some kinds of meaning and value need a transcendent source. So, given the second premise, there is no transcendent source, you get a modified conclusion. There are no meanings and values of that kind. But I don't think Nietzsche really thought that there were no meanings and values and that life was meaningless.
Well, it's complicated. I mean, in one sense, he clearly is a nihilist. There is no transcendent meaning to ground the meaning that comes out of human projects and commitments. But in another sense, he's not. And although he's a little confusing about this, human projects and commitments are themselves, just in themselves, a valid source of meaning.
So maybe in these broad strokes, this bird's eye way of looking at it thing, our very eminent guest today is in spirit a Nietzschean, if I'm sure not in detail.
Well, that's Hubert Dreyfus, professor emeritus at Berkeley, author of many influential books, and co-author of a forthcoming book that's right on our topic. It's called A Life Worth Living, Luring Back the Gods in Our Secular Age.
He'll join us in just a bit. And we'll also want our live audience here at the Marsh to join in the conversation, too.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, April Dymbosky, talks to someone who found nihilism at the root of a musical revolution. She files this report.
Punk music was a backlash against the hippie and disco generations. Young musicians in the late 70s were sick of the political messages and commercial images of bands like the Eagles and Journey. They started writing songs about hopelessness, despair, and no future.
It's a catchy phrase. There's a lot of young people who could relate to that.
Writer Jack Boulware has co-authored a book on the history of the punk scene in San Francisco. Gimme Something Better chronicles the early days when art students watched British punk bands insult newscasters on TV, and follows the scene into the 80s, when things got really nihilistic.
It turned into this kind of slam dancing mosh pit kind of scene, and people got bloodied at this show. Somebody got their nose broken. It was extremely violent. It's just this huge outburst of adrenaline, energy. Somebody screams for 11 seconds. You can't understand any of the words, and then it's over.
Younger and younger kids joined the scene, especially runaways who left broken homes, but they found even less structure among other punks.
There's parties all night long. People are shooting you off of speed. You don't know where you are. You're awake for 3 days. I don't think any of them really were consciously thinking, I'm a nihilist and I'm 11 years old. They were really just trying to survive.
Things got even worse when the skinheads showed up.
Nightclubs would have to be closed because too many skinheads would show up to the show, pick a bunch of fights. A lot of people would see tile in the audience.
But even in its most nihilistic manifestations, punk was still a movement. People gathered for concerts, they started magazines, they connected over the music. Fans found meaning in the meaninglessness. Writer Eric Davis says this is common in counterculture movements.
Individual nihilism can also coexist with meaningful activity, but it becomes harder and harder to say what it means when it's a way that people go out together and bond and share and, you know, relate and communicate. Like, all of those things are inherently meaning-making positions.
Even violence and apathy take on new connotations.
The nihilism of punk becomes, in a way, part of a performance where the performance itself actually has a lot of meaning, culturally constructive meaning involved in it.
Eventually, punks launched a backlash against their own backlash. The search for meaning became outright. The Nazis moved on. Kids rejected drugs and became straight edge. Author Jack Boulware says they organized and helped each other.
People started organizing squatting projects. Soup kitchens started working with punk kids. There was some organization around how young people can, you know, be part of the scene and not just get chewed up by the system.
The 80s ended, and by the 90s, the punk rock kids had to grow up. Many of them left their nihilistic teen years far in the past.
A lot of people became professors, lawyers, psychologists, youth counselors, drug counselors. For those people who lived through it, they wanted to make the place a better world, and so that's where they took their life.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm April Dymbosky.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, and you're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
And we're joined now by Hubert Dreyfus. He's professor emeritus of philosophy from the UC Berkeley. He's author of lots of cool stuff about AI and Heidegger and all that, but he's authored, relevant to our current purposes, of a forthcoming book, co-authored with Sean Kelly, a book called A Life Worth Living, Luring Back the Gods in Our Secular Age. Hubert, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks.
Hubert, you've written about existentialism, AI, Heidegger, and so much more. But how does your new book, with its theme, Luring Back the Gods, fit into your career?
Well, it is sort of surprising even to me. But I guess the unifying theme is interest in mastery, in skills. Then once upon a time, that was a criticism of AI and expert systems. But masters also bring together people around them, and sometimes gods. I was just watching a program about this, in which sums it up perfectly. A flamenco master sings his thing, and if he does it very, very well, they will yell "Olé." But it turns out, I just learned, that in the old days they used to say "Allah." But bit by bit, it got deformed. Oh. And so that when the singer becomes transcendent and just carried away beside himself and so forth, then the people yell God, in effect. That is, something transcendent, as you guys have been talking about, shines through him. And all I wanted to add is, I don't believe in anything really transcendent in the sort of metaphysical sense, but there is something that he doesn't control that controls him.
So the topic of the show is nihilism. Your new book is about nihilism. Give us your definition of nihilism.
Well, I don't have a finished one. Nietzsche said it was when the top values lost their value. It's that fact that there are no more guidelines for making important decisions in your life. But I think it's got two sides. I mean, that's the sort of situation, that there are none of these guidelines. But then there's the sort of reaction to it. And that's the more interesting thing. What do you do in a situation like that?
But let's slow down a little bit. You say there are no guidelines for making decisions in your life. Well, there are the things I want, the things I value. I mean, there may not be external authorities, although there are things that parade as external authorities. I mean, if there's no God, okay, then there's tradition, there's history, there's your community, there's your parents. I mean, they all offer themselves as authorities over you for deciding how to live your life, what you should do, what's worth pursuing, what isn't. What do you mean when you say there are no guidelines?
Well, that's a good point. I think that the people who hear the parents and the usual tradition and so forth don't believe it anymore. By some happy coincidence, I just happen to have a Dylan song here which says this better than I can say it. I'll just read it. Darkness at noon, people make everything from toy guns that spark and flesh-colored Christs that grow in the dark. It's easy to see without looking too far that nothing much is really sacred. I've got nothing, Ma, to live up to. There's no sense in trying. It's all right, Ma, I'm only dying. That's a nihilistic reaction to all the things you listed. Well, they don't work anymore.
Okay. In times gone by, people thought that their lives should be shaped by some transcendent authority. And if you ask to God, why God, you get like Job. You get God saying, well, where the hell were you when I created the universe? So you have no business asking me why. So I'm an unquestionable authority. Why should the breakdown of that, let's say, false, pretend unquestioned authority, why should it amount to nihilism? I mean, why shouldn't it just say, oh, we were wrong about the ultimate source of meaning and value. It isn't some transcendent God. It isn't history. It isn't your parents. It's something about your own will, your own aspirations, your own projects. Why not say that?
Well, good. I mean, you're a perfect Nietzschean, because what Nietzsche said was that passive nihilism is the bad kind that gives up. I was just reading a passive nihilist Dylan song, and that in effect, nothing is worth doing. Nothing, it isn't worth living. The old values are all gone. Nothing is sacred. But that was what Nietzsche called passive nihilism. And then he said, but active nihilism is, what an opportunity. We can now give things any meaning that we please. We can can commit ourselves to anything we please. We don't need any external authority.
Well, yeah. That's fine for Nietzsche, but he was writing before the 20th century. Now we've gone through the 20th century, and we it was horrible, right? And can we really? We saw where this freedom leads. It leads to Nazism and fascism on the one hand, and Stalin on the other, and various things, the Vietnam War. I mean, there must be some right and wrong to it that we could get back to, don't you think?
Well, whether we can get back to it or not is really a question of whether it grabs us or not, whether it has authority for us or not. And the situation, it seems to be, it doesn't anymore. And that's the problem. And Nietzsche's positive nihilism is part of the problem. And this is I want to add something, that if one says, well, let's become what Nietzsche calls free spirits and give our lives and everything else meaning, then it doesn't have the old transcendent authority. That's gone. But it doesn't have a new kind of authority either, because once you give the meaning, it hasn't any authority. You can just take it back.
Well, I want to challenge you on that point, but after a break.
But so prepare for a challenge. We have an authority here.
Yes, this is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. We're discussing nihilism and meaning with Hubert Dreyfus from UC Berkeley.
We've been talking about what nihilism is and where it comes from. Next, we're going to consider responses to it. What can be done when you're overcome or inundated with feelings about the meaninglessness of it all?
Responses to nihilism, along with questions from our live audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. Are life and existence without a God vacant and meaningless? Can we repair the gap by making up our own principles and trying to stick to them? Those are the questions. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about nihilism and meaning with Hubert Dreyfus from UC Berkeley.
Do you ground the meaning of your own life in how God wants things to go? Or in what projects you've committed yourself to? Or in some combination thereof? If God is dead or tired or has some fatal wasting disease, does it follow that everything is permitted? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either side of the stage and making your life meaningful again.
So, Hubert, I know that you have an answer to nihilism, but I want to wallow in nihilism a little bit. And I want to actually challenge an inference you made. Because you said, well, if you make it up yourself, then it has no authority. Okay, that's like the kid who discovers that mom and dad are just people like him, and that he can do what he chooses to do. He doesn't have to. Mom and dad are not unquestioned authority. And then it's like you think, well, my God, mom and dad are unquestioned authority. What am I to do? Well, the answer is take control of your life. Live your life. Commit yourself to things. I mean, why? I don't understand the logic that now there is no basis for living my life unless there's something external to me to which I must hand over my life. I just think that's a fallacious inference.
Okay, suppose you say commit yourself to something, and then somebody says, why this, whatever it is? And that's when Nietzsche says, quote, the why finds no answer. And so there you are. How can you take seriously, make sacrifices for?
Because this is the life that I undertake. I hereby undertake this life. I hereby undertake to be a philosopher. Because it's what I want. It answers to the things that I aspire to.
But if I say, well, I decide I'm not going to be a Nazi. I'm not going to be a slaveholder. But, you know, if you want to decide something different, it's really completely symmetrical. Can we really live with that?
Well, we do. I mean, the world is, there are Nazis, there are slaveholders, there are abolitionists. Sure. Now, here's what's true. My authority may not transmit to you. It may not transmit to anybody other than myself, but, okay, so what?
So you're a nihilist.
Well, how is that a nihilism?
Well, why do that rather than anything else? There's no authority in it. There's no conviction in it. Tomorrow you could just wake up and do some different thing.
Wait a minute. Why is there no conviction in it?
Well, but conviction can change any time. Try this. Let's try a Sartre kind of nihilism.
Yeah.
So you're free to give your life any meaning. Okay, his example is a gambler who gives his life the meaning he's not going to gamble anymore one evening. And he's full of authority. It's his decision, and he's got free will, and he does it. Right. And then the next morning he wakes up and he decides now he's going to freely gamble that evening. I mean, nothing of the previous decision had any reason, and therefore it has no grip on him, and therefore he can change it, or it can just change all the time.
So the nice thing about God or other transcendent authorities, the nice comforting thing was that if you were ever tempted to live a different life, God would say, oh, no, you don't. And if you said to God, well, why? What reason would God give you? I mean, where is there more reason with God around? God would say, no, you don't, because I'm big and powerful, and you're just a little...
And where were you when I made the heavens and earth? Yeah. And what, you know...
Is that God's answer?
That would be one kind of answer. It would be better if there were some kind of answer that didn't require that kind of authority,
yeah,
but had some kind of authority. And that's where we should be trying to look, it seems to me.
I mean, there seems to be a plenty of room between the view that we need transcendent God-derived values and the view that all we have is our own particular consciousness. There's nature, there's human life, there's reason. All of these things might be grounded in our own existence, but have a little more objectivity than just, I've decided this right now.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you live from the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground, for a new performance in front of a live audience, and we'd love to have questions from that live audience. Step up to the mic on either side of the theater, and we'll get to you. And we have a question here now. Tell us who you are and tell us what your question is. Welcome to Philosophy
Talk. Tom Merle. I was going to make the point that was just made, which is the authority may be grounded in us. That is, we have a certain kind of hard wiring, it's referred to. We have genetic predispositions. We have temperaments. And through evolution or through the development of society, these tendencies then lead to, there are differences among individuals, but they lead to social relations. They lead to the good life. Considered broadly, so you don't really need a grand puppeteer. You have nature developing its own dynamic, which then advances civilization by virtue of what works and what doesn't.
Well, that's so, Hubert, what do you think? Nature.
Well, what counts as works and not working?
Well, what counts is what again advances that particular society. The species or the race or whatever it is that you want to continue. So through sexual selection, there's other kinds of dynamics built into the biology of species. That's what's setting the direction, not an external mandate.
But let's go back to something John said in passing, because we've all lived through the 20th century or some chunk of it, and the 20th century was a century of horrors. You know, worldwide economic collapse, so capitalism didn't look like it was going to work. Communism and the Gulag, Nazism and the Holocaust, you know, Pol Pot, apartheid. I mean, it's a century. It was a century of horrors. And that was all...
Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would think that you couldn't get from the dynamic of history, you know, and nature an answer to your question, could you?
Well, if you could, I think you'd be sort of like an animal. You'd be compelled by the way things have evolved to have a certain bunch of values and act in a certain way. It doesn't sound like you're doing anything. You're just a product of the way the genes have been stacked. And that doesn't seem like an answer to how you could lead a good life, but maybe just how the species could advance itself through you. If that's enough to satisfy you, then that's an answer to nihilism, all right. But
I mean, there seems to be what G.E. Moore called the open question argument here. He said, well, look, this is right. This gives the heads authority because this is what's good for human being, or this is what's good for my society. Well, yeah, but maybe your society isn't one that ought to thrive. Well, but this is what's good for human beings. Well, maybe human beings were a colossal evolutionary mistake, and life on Earth would be better off without them. And who's to say life on Earth is such a good thing anyway? So no matter what you choose, even if it gives you an internal logic, you can always ask this question, but why does that matter? It's very disturbing.
Something that silences that question, why, that ends the why question. We've got another question here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Tell us your name and then your comment or question.
My name is Rodrigo, and my question is less about nihilism itself as to how many of us are nihilistic. So if nihilism is the absence of any ultimate values, and so many of us speak with the rhetoric of creating values for ourselves or assuming or committing ourselves to values, then how do we make sense of those who would play down their actual values as just talk or just preferences, and yet then want to impose themselves on others by the advance of things like tolerance or democracy or values that seem to be universal when you get past the considerations of nihilism? In other words, so the question is, are we really nihilistic or not in modern America?
That's a question for you, Hubert.
Yeah, I can see that. But I'm not sure I have any kind of answer there. We have values, I think you're saying, like tolerance and democracy and so forth, which we accept and impose on others. That doesn't seem very nihilistic. I guess all I could say about that is that reflective people, like Dylan, for instance, seem to not be satisfied with the fact that we unreflectively and dogmatically just take on values. We ought to be able to defend them. They ought to be grounded. And that's what you're saying we don't need to do, or we aren't doing. I think the answer is we're not asking the why question. We're not trying to ground why this way of action is better than some other. We're just taking over what people think is the thing to do,
but
uncritically.
But imagine an abolitionist faced with a slaveholder. And they have an argument. You say, we ought to be able to justify them. They have an argument about whether slaveholding is acceptable or not. And at some point, the argument runs out. And an abolitionist can feel entitled somehow, even though the argument has run out. But the abolitionist has satisfied herself or himself that he can coerce the other into ending slavery. That's what the Civil War was partly about, or it became about, right? What is that situation when we say, okay, we tried to argue with you, but we're not going to. Is that nihilism? But the arguments end. There is nothing that will end the argument. We could go on forever, but we're not going to go on forever, and I'm going to stop you from holding slaves.
I don't think that's... I don't see that the nihilist has to have an answer to that. It seems to me, unless you say that because in order to make life worth living, you got to be free, and you can't be free if the other people aren't free too, that kind of argument that people use, then at least you can start attacking it. But if they just say, well, conversation is broken down, it's time to get the army now because we're going to get rid of you.
Well, I was trying to make the point that you said that in a nihilistic age when we think there are no transcendent authorities, everything lacks conviction. But I think, no, we can have conviction. I can, as the abolitionist, have the conviction that slavery will end, and I will force you to end it.
So, I mean, it seems to me that there's a distinction that we need to make here between what you might call psychological and philosophical nihilism. Psychological nihilism is the feeling that everything is meaningless and having it completely sap your energy so you don't get out of bed in the morning. And I think there is a cure for psychological nihilism, at least for most people. It's to get out of bed, maybe with an alarm clock, not with a philosophical argument, but with an alarm clock, or a cat that sits on your head until you let it out, or a dog that pulls on you, or in my case, all of the above, a wife that kicks you. And then get committed to something. Put yourself in a situation where something you care about will happen, you know. And the psychological nihilism will lift. If it doesn't, then you better see a shrink and get some medicine. But there's ways out of it. But the philosophical nihilism, that is, can I really give an argument the way my grandparents could that this is the right way to go because God exists and he said so? That's a different problem. So that's my distinction.
I think that's a good one.
We've got more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. Alan of Berkeley. Professor Dreyfus, could you read us your invitation or tell us the invitation to God? Getting God back?
Luring
God
back.
Okay, I see. Yeah, tell us what I have in mind or what we have in mind. That phrase, by the way, is from Melville. Moby Dick is all about these kind of issues. And he talks about luring back the gods. And now comes the interesting thing. What he means by the gods, he says, is the Homeric gods. So now we have to think about what were gods in, say, the Odyssey. That's when I started reading and teaching the Odyssey, because I wanted to, I surely we're not going to go back to those gods, those people-like gods that come around and so forth. What is there in that that we can use? Well, then Heidegger says, well, the Greek gods are really the attuning ones. And you might wonder, well, what does that mean?
Yeah, Heidegger's, what does that mean?
Exactly. Heidegger's not telling you, and Heidegger's not citing any text, which is very annoying. So I decided I'll have to figure it out myself. And now, this is going to take a minute. I have to tell you what it would be like. Let's look at the case of Helen and Paris. And Helen runs off with Paris. And in the Odyssey, there's a dinner party in which all the important aristocrats and great heroes are there. And Helen's telling the story of how she, when Aphrodite shined on them, she just left her husband and her newborn child and ran off to Troy. And what's going on? And what's more, the audience isn't shocked. They think that's great. Homer says at the end of that chapter, Helen is peerless among women. Well, what's going on there? Well, the god, Aphrodite in this case, shines on them. That means they get attuned to what's erotic in the situation, and only what's erotic, not domestic and children and so forth and so forth. And then this higher authority, in the sense that it guides them and tells them what to do, namely the Aphrodite, takes over. So that's the gods then. Are going to be, among other things, the moods that can take over a person or take over a whole city or take over a whole culture. They're not under your control. You can't will them and choose them the way we've been talking about things. And they will give your life meaning. The Greeks knew for when Ares yelled, then everybody was in an aggressive mood and they would fight and kill each other.
So the gods for you are sort of external things that call you to do something, to which you respond, yeah. not projections out of you, not things that you invest with meaning, but they're external things that call to you. Yeah. And being attuned to them, as you put it, is somehow the source of meaningfulness. Because nothing internal could be?
Well, they're not things that call you, and you can't get attuned to them. That's still too Greek. I'm not going to embrace that, but that's got too much metaphysical stuff in it. But there are these forces, let's call them, that guide people, and you can be receptive to those forces. And the highest good for those Homeric Greeks turns out to be Helen's way of being open and receptive to these forces, no matter what. And everybody thinks great.
So just a quick question. I don't have too much time, but would music be a good example? Because music seems to me something that does call to us. It's objective. We can't help its feeling. And people who are a little good at it can be very committed to it. It makes their life meaningful.
So, I think, yes, I mean, it isn't a Homer example, but I think it's a terrific example. That's right. There are these forces to which you can be receptive, and the more receptive, the better.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing nihilism and meaning with Hubert Dreyfus from UC Berkeley, co-author of the forthcoming book, A Life Well Lived, Luring Back the Gods.
So how exactly do we cope with a universe that is missing God or gods? Next, we'll consider how we can re-enchant the universe. As a matter of fact, we've already started to consider that. How we can lure back the gods.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more nihilistic questions, or meaningful questions, from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions nothing and everything else.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing nihilism and meaning with Hubert Dreyfus from the UC Berkeley. And we've got lots of questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Thank you. I'm Denise from San Francisco. It seems we seem to be creating quite a long narrative about nihilism, which to me would indicate that we're authenticating ourselves, and therefore nihilism seems to be defeated as an argument through that narrative.
Authenticate means
authenticating in terms of establishing meaning for ourselves.
So by telling ourselves this nihilistic story about who we are, where we fit, the very narrating of it is structuring and giving meaning to our lives.
That's pretty weird. I don't get it. Because I don't see how a narrative saying that, let's take the extremist form, there's no meaning, psychological or ontological, and therefore that narrative now has given us some direction.
But suppose I come out of graduate school, I'm so offended by all these various people that are telling me life is meaningful that I devote my life to showing they're all wrong. There is no meaning. Kant is wrong and Plato is wrong and...
I see. Then my life has meaning.
Right?
I see. Yes. Then you've got a cause. I see your point.
By undertaking to live as a nihilist.
Yes.
Undertaking to live. We got another.
So
this
nihilism is kind of self-defeating in a sense.
In a certain way.
I mean, why do it? The why would come back, and we'd be in that mess.
We got another question from a live audience.
My name is Caitlin from San Francisco. I know you've written a lot about computers, technology, and the internet. I'm part of a generation that's grown up with the internet and kind of this groundless quality that the internet has. How do you think the rise of the internet has contributed to this nihilistic quality today, if you do?
Yeah, interesting question, because I wrote a book on the internet in which I tried to deal with that, and I think it has contributed because in the world of the internet, there's this sort of disembodied, non-committed way of life. How many know about Second Life? That's the best example of this. I mean, Second Life, this world on the internet, the virtual world, as it's called. In the virtual world, commitments are totally unreal. I mean, if you don't like what's going on, then just, teleport to someplace else where you do like it. And your bodies don't tell you anything. People don't eat or drink or I don't know whether they have sex or not. That's just a weird question for Second Life. But whatever it is, it seems so... It is disembodied, utterly. Insofar, I guess, as people spend a lot of energy in Second Life, that's certainly nihilism plus, as far as I can see. I mean, I wonder, because I tried it. I had a discussion section in Second Life, because my podcast got people interested from all over the world who kept saying, wouldn't it be nice if we could talk to you and talk to each other? So I said, good, we'll have a virtual discussion section. It didn't work very well.
I don't play Second Life, but my avatar does.
I want to go back to luring back the gods. I mean, in some sense, I understand your view, but I really want to probe it a little more deeply. Because, look, I agree that a kind of responsiveness to, let's call it, the normative character of things is good. I mean, so to be awed by something beautiful, right, to be humbled by something overpowering, to be sympathetic to a person in need, to feel, I mean, right, those things, those things in some sense call to us. And I think that's an important dimension of human life, and learning to see the world in these normatively laden terms. And I agree that if we take God out of the picture and we take, you know, if we think that, like Nietzsche, the world is just stuff in motion ultimately and there's no value at the bottom of the universe, it's difficult how to see to build it back in, right? But this prescription that is luring back the gods, that's mystical to me. I mean, the Homeric gods were fictions, were figments. They were really just projections onto a world that doesn't have meaning in its own self of human meaning. We invested these things with meaning.
I just interject myself as Ken's question goes across the table to Hubert here. I mean, there's kind of being really real, and there's being fictions, and there's something else in between, which is being astute personifications. And that's what it seems to me we've got here. These are real forces in our life that, in fact, do give it meaning. The Christian monotheistic theology screwed it all up, saying it all had to be packed in one container, and that didn't work out very well. we might argue. But they're not fictions. They're not quite real. But, I mean, they're personifications of real things. That's how I read you.
Good. And I sort of buy the first half of what you said. You gave a good story about receptivity to all sorts of things which make life meaningful. And those are the gods, the modern version of the gods, like Aphrodite. I mean, there's still situations in which the erotic aspects are all that shows up to the people in them. And that's a force that we have to reckon with and be grateful for. And that works. But then, well, why not just have that? Well, there's an enemy we should talk about. The enemy is Kant. Yeah. Somebody coming along and saying, well, what you ought to do is be autonomous. Don't let these things, in big words, heteronomously determine your life. That is, don't get dragged around by your desires and by your receptivity. Be in total control of your life. That's what gets us in
trouble. Well, okay, in a way, but you're under... I love Kant.
That's why I say it, and
you are laboring under an illusion, I would say, in my content, that these things that are in some sense really connected to your will and you're giving yourself a life plan and trying to share it with others, that they're somehow independent of you and that you are only to bow to them, right? As if not my will, but thy will be done, right? So you're trying to project outward what is really only rooted in your own will. And okay, now once I tell you that it's an illusion, you're the guy who says, oh my God, it's really only up to me in the end. Well, it always was only up to you.
But that's the illusion, this will that you talk about, that trumps everything and is really always you. You don't give the erotic force to the situation. The situation draws it out of you. And Kant would say, aha, then it's bad. It's I was looking for a word for it. It's not exactly wicked or sinful, but what is it to be heteronomously determined? It's not a good thing.
It's not self-governing, yeah. It's
hard to spell.
We got more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Velocity Talk, Man.
Hi, my name is Miriam from San Francisco. And with regard to Nietzsche and nihilism, I am wondering, in what sense does Nietzsche's eternal recurrence perhaps provide a ground for meaning?
Whoa, good question. We have to explain to people what that is that you're talking about. And so Nietzsche says that the world is, the whole universe repeats itself, and he has an argument that since there's a finite number of particles and an infinite amount of time, is that in his picture, everything is going to repeat itself over and over and over, and that's the eternal return. And then he makes it into a kind of ethical principle, namely, you got to have the strength to will your life in every detail to be repeated over and over, to not let that become something that depresses you or drives you to suicide or makes you think, well, I'd like to save the good parts, but there's some awful, disgusting, and depressing parts, and I don't want them to be repeated over and over. You've got to be strong enough to face that. Well, I don't know what to think. Nietzsche does think that's the answer to nihilism. And to me, it's just too far-fetched to really get a grip on.
It's a stranger idea.
But it's a test of whether you've lived your life in a way that you can own it, right? So here, okay. I'm going to offer you exactly this life, right? If you reject it, that means you have not lived it. You have not lived it as your life. You've lived it as an alien thing. If you own this life in all of its details, then you've lived this life. It's your living. It's sort of quasi-Kantian, except...
crazy Kant. There's a little ambiguity there. I mean, if I could live my life over again as opposed to nothing, I suppose I'd live it over again. It's had a lot of good moments. But if I had my choice of living my life just as it was over again and making some improvements, I would definitely make some improvements.
Well, again, that's a test that you haven't owned this life of yours.
It's not a test that I haven't lived my life. It's just a realization that certain decisions were mistaken. Nietzsche's out of his gourd.
So you're gods. You say luring back the gods. In something you wrote, you said it's not so much that God has died, but we've turned our back on them, and they're calling out to us plaintively to return. Tell me what you mean by that. That would be our last comment.
You've given me the content. I mean, that's the receptivity thing. We've turned our back on it by making it saying autonomy, that is all us making our life plan, choosing our life and all that, is what it's really about. Whereas all around, there's all these wonderful things to be receptive to, emotions, music, your country, and that's fine. I mean, that's what I want to defend in luring back the gods that are waiting. All the things that can give you meaning, provided you will be receptive and not try to be autonomous.
Right, not try to be autonomous. On that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. I don't know if I'm doing that of my own will or responding with gratitude towards the press.
It's a right and meaningful thing to do.
So thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Our guest has been Hubert Dreyfus, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy from the UC Berkeley, co-author with Sean Kelly of A Life Well Lived, Luring Back the Gods in a Secular Age.
And we also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So John, what are your final or penultimate or... penultimate thoughts.
My final meaningful thought.
Yeah.
I wrote a little poem for the occasion. God is great and God is good. He gives us values, meaning, and food. What he doesn't do, sadly, is exist. And that has left philosophers irked. But you can't have everything.
On that note... This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And we have a ever-growing Facebook page, so if you frequent Facebook, sign up and be a fan on our Facebook page.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For a final word, we're going to turn to a man on the fast track to oblivion, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, nihilism is the belief that values do not intrinsically exist, but are inventions. Friedrich Nietzsche often thought the godfather of nihilism wrote, quote, I do not reproach nihilism's arrival. I believe it is one of the greatest crises, a moment of the deepest self-reflection of humanity. Whether man recovers from it, whether he becomes master of this crisis, is a question of his strength, unquote. Well, gee, how did that whole nihilism thing turn out for us? We'll get to that. But first, let's backtrack to ancient Greece. There was no such thing as nothingness back then. No, sir. Back in Aristotle's day, it was all nature abhors a vacuum. Nothing could not possibly exist. It didn't make any sense. Everything is something. How can something contain nothing? Then, in the 17th century, a fellow named Torricelli actually created a vacuum, and nothing officially became one more something. Eventually, in the 20th century, the vacuum became a valuable tool in creating light bulbs, vacuum tubes, and various tools requiring suction. Unfortunately, it's been bad news lately for void lovers. For those who believe that if you stare into the void also stares into you, now you now have to add that if you stare at the void, it's not really a void anymore because it now contains the radiation emitted by your eyes. Nothing's perfect anymore, not even a vacuum. Thank you, quantum physics. Thank you for nothing, by which, of course, I mean something. So nihilism has led to the trickle-down version of nihilism, which is that life is meaningless, therefore, what the hell, let's bust up the bar. Dada, surrealism, heavy metal, punk rock, the rise of Nazis, hippies, school killings, all have been laid at nihilism's untidy door. But what about the resulting mixed metaphors? I have read that the moral vacuum, vacated by ethics, has been filled by pop culture, which, no longer infused by ethics or morality, gives us instead shows about nothing, like Seinfeld or Pulp Fiction. But I read elsewhere that nihilism, in the modern sense, doesn't come from nothing. That is, kids who kill don't just pop out of a vacuum. So what is it? Does something come from nothing, or does nothing come from something? I don't know. I only know that you can't get nothing from nothing. Well, you can, but what do you have, really? I mean, once you look at it, I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Kadar Lawrence.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, April Dombowski, Merle Kessler, Kathy McClanahan, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch are our directors of research. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Stanford Humanities Center, various groups at Stanford University, and the Friends of Philosophy Talk.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk. Your support helps keep Philosophy Talk on the air and online.
We appreciate your support.
And as always, thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.